We enjoy bashing our political leaders. We must, because we do it a lot, and not just now, but throughout the American history. And the most visible political role in the United States is, of course, the presidency. There's a rich history of applying nicknames and tags to the chief executive, and Ashland's Ed Battistella taps into that rich history in his book, Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels, subtitled Insulting the President from Washington to Trump. Ed Battistella is one of your neighbors, a professor in the English department at Southern Oregon University, where he teaches linguistics and writing. His previous book that we talked to him about here on The Exchange is Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. Ed Battistella, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So this book is pretty much the opposite of apologies, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of how it got started. I was talking to an editor friend of mine about the 2016 election, and she was kind of lamenting that there were not a lot of great books about American political insults, but there were plenty about British ones. And I mentioned that, an insult is just sort of the opposite of an apology. And she encouraged me to send in a proposal. And then a couple of years later, we have a book.
We do indeed. Now, and you take us back a bit. You've gotten quite an education in insults generally. I have to believe these are as old as human beings themselves.
It is. You know, I've always been interested in insults. I grew up in New Jersey, where it's sort of the coin of the realm. And, you know, there are Shakespearean insults and the Old Norse flightings and so on. You know, everything all the way up to Oscar Wilde, who once said about Henry James that he writes fiction as if it were a painful duty. So I really sort of enjoyed going back into some of the classic histories and doing the research and seeing what people said about Washington and Adams and Jefferson, all the way up to present day.
Well, now that's the interesting thing, though. I mean, I guess nobody should be surprised, given the general nature of political discourse in America, that even, you know, the saints like Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln were not exempt. It sounds like all of our presidents, no matter how formidable, were insulted.
They were, and Washington really took a lot of abuse. Some of it even from his own cabinet. John Adams, who was his vice president, referred to him as old muttonhead and said that the only reason he hadn't been found out as being stupid was that he kept his mouth shut. And Jefferson famously resigned from the cabinet and started the Democratic Republican Party. And so he was... Jefferson was a lot more cagey about his criticism. He would often hire newspaper people to write it for him, a practice that continued up through the 1800 election.
Now, you just mentioned criticism. You differentiate between insults and criticism. Give us the dividing line.
Yeah, it's a sort of tricky line. If you go to the person sort of ad hominem and talk about somebody being stupid, so I could sort of say that I think something is wrongheaded or incorrect or poorly done or bad policy. But if you attack the person, then it's really a sort of, you know, in your face insult. So I'm thinking back to when that South Carolina congressman said to Barack Obama, "You lie."
Right in the middle of a State of the Union address.
Right in the middle of the State of the Union address. So the context and the sort of ferocity of his statement really, you know, moved it from being a criticism of the speech to an in-the-moment insult. And that's the way all the commentators took it.
So how do insults of presidents compare with historical insults of major figures in other fields? I mean, is there kind of a choice thing here, or do they get less than perhaps actors get, for example?
Yeah, I think actors get really kind of insulted on their craft, on their performance, on their work. Presidents tend to be insulted in it's a remarkably stable set of categories. I have a little thesaurus of insult categories in the back of the Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels. But there'll be insults about sex, about intelligence. So you can either be not smart enough or too smart. There are insults about being honest, lots of insults about weakness. So back in Washington's day, you know, they would talk about somebody as being pusillanimous. Mm-hmm. Right? Whereas today we might refer to them as being a wimp.
Right. Yeah, we've changed a couple of different categories that are general.
Yeah, the words change, but the categories are sort of remarkably stable.
Mm-hmm. As you remind us, the ability to insult the president is cause for a celebration in American freedoms. There is, as you point out, though, something else, intensification through adjectives. And you give the example of something that Goldwater said about Nixon.
Yeah, he called him a two-fisted, four-square liar. I guess at the time he sort of saw Nixon as being too liberal and hard to fathom. But yeah, he intensifies it with both the numbers, two-fisted and four-square. And there's a kind of literary quality to the repetition there that that really sort of, you know, drives it home, right? When you can make the same insult in several ways. And a lot of these have to do with sort of words I can't say on the radio, where they're intensified that way. But there are some that are also fairly general public. So another one of my favorites that uses a kind of repetition for intensification was something that Hunter S. Thompson, the gonzo journalist, mm-hmm. said about Nixon. He called him a swine of a man and a jabbering dupe of a president. And you get that sort of "and" in there, bringing things together, and it talks about him as a person and then his performance in office. So that's where you see the difference between, you know, what you might have with actors or radio personalities or professors.
Edwin Battistella, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, sharing his delight in language with an examination of the horrible things that have been said about presidents over the years, some of them just downright funny, some of them kind of really low, but the book is called Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels, Insulting the President from Washington to Trump. I point out again, this is not a how-to book, although you can take your own ideas from it. We'll come back and talk more with Ed Battistella. If you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Ed, the table of contents is a bit of a revelation. Did any president not have a derisive nickname?
You know, I thought there might be some that it would be hard to find some material on, because there were a few that served very short terms: Garfield, William Henry Harrison, and so on. But they all had interesting careers before that and made plenty of enemies who really had lots to say about them. And often you find historians kind of repeating some of this later on, so there was no dearth of material.
Do you have a favorite nickname among the 45?
Oh, you know, I really sort of enjoyed some of the alliteration. So there were things, both Lyndon Johnson and Andrew Johnson were known as Judas Johnson. Uh-huh. Right? So the sort of alliteration works there for them. But you also had Franklin Pierce, who died of cirrhosis of the liver a few years after he left office. But he had a lifelong drinking problem, and at one point he fell off a horse. His nickname was Fainting Frank.
Wow.
So they sort of characterized it as fainting, but he probably just passed out.
As long as we're talking about Franklin Pierce, I want to bring up his other nickname, because you mentioned his drinking problem, because his other, chapter title is The Hero of Many a Well-Fought Bottle.
Yeah, some of these are just sort of terrific, and that was an attack that was used against him by the Whig Party, which was just about, Pierce was the last person to run against a Whig candidate. After that, it was you had the Republicans emerging. But you often find these kinds of great slogans. So there must be some real unattributed wits out there. Another one of my favorites was when William Henry Harrison ran against Henry Clay, Henry Clay was certainly an old scoundrel. William Henry Harrison's slogan was Tippecanoe and Tyler too, right, from the Battle of Tippecanoe. Mm-hmm. And one of the Whig party leaders said it had rhyme but no reason. I'm sort of waiting to use that at some point.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. So let's see. I wondered if you found that some of the terms might have changed in the years soon after presidency. You know, when the analysts and the historians begin kind of taking stock of where things went over the course of a presidency when it is no longer active. And I wonder if some people gained nicknames later on, or maybe the edges softened a bit on the public perceptions.
Yeah, well, they certainly did for me. As I learned more about some of the presidents, some of the impressions that I went into changed. One of the ones that I sort of recall early on, well, I guess John F. Kennedy's a good example, where he became much more of a sort of revered figure after his assassination. But at the time, he was sort of attacked from often from the mostly from the right, but often from the left as well. Bertrand Russell called him more wicked than Hitler.
Wow.
Because he hadn't signed the nuclear test ban treaty. But some of the Texas Democrats who were supporting Johnson for the presidency referred to him as Mr. Boston Beans.
Wow. And
so you get everything from the sort of, you know, comical to the some really horrific insults.
Ed Battistella, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels, Insulting the President from Washington to Trump. It's a very long history. Well, let's go back to old Muttonhead, as described by his own vice president, George Washington. Now, we're going to switch animals here because Thomas Paine had a beef with Washington. What was that about, and how did he express it?
Yeah, this is, you know, I hadn't realized this before, but Thomas Paine, he was the author of Common Sense, one of the sort of founding documents of the Revolution. And he was kind of you could sort of think of him as a professional revolutionary. He went off to France after the U.S. gained its independence to work with the advocates of the French Revolution. And he was thrown in jail by Robespierre. And when he was thrown in jail, the U.S. and France were allies, and it would have been a sort of simple matter for Washington and his French ambassador to try to get Thomas Paine sprung from the French jail by declaring that he was a U.S. citizen, but they declined, and the French kept him in jail for about a year as a British citizen. So when he came back, he wrote a long letter. This was sort of before emails and Twitter. And so he wrote a long letter, several thousand words, to Washington on his birthday, kind of politely but pointedly inquiring why he hadn't done anything and whether, what was the source of this pusillanimity. Washington ignored it. He was often stung by criticism, but he generally ignored it and would kind of complain privately to his aides about the barbs that were coming from the press and others.
Mm-hmm.
About a year later, Paine wrote a longer pamphlet. I think it was something like maybe 10,000 words or so, in which he sort of publicly took Washington to task as a hypocrite, a weak general, a liar, and again, Washington just sort of ignored it, but he was pretty clearly stung by this.
You mentioned that Jefferson even helped heap some scorn on Washington, which is interesting to think of the founders once again as pretty frequently in opposition to each other. We move on to President number two. His rotundity, John Adams, was one of the names for him. He really didn't like criticism, did he?
No, in fact, I mean, one of the things that Adams did was he instituted the Alien and Sedition Acts, which made it a crime to criticize the president. And I think there were something like 18 or so, I forget the exact number, people who were prosecuted under that, including people, one person who just sort of complained about the size of the president's butt in a bar or something like that. But yeah, Jefferson would had some journalists that he would pay to plant stories, sort of like Well, you could probably find an analog today without the pay part. Mm-hmm. And one of them was Benjamin Franklin Batchy, who was the grandson of the other Benjamin Franklin. And in his paper, he referred to Adams as old, querulous, bald, blind, crippled, and toothless.
Boy, didn't leave anything out there, did they?
Didn't leave anything out. And James Callender also referred to Adams as a repulsive pedant. Mm-hmm. And attacked his gender as well, called him weak and womanish. Callender, it turns out, later turned on Jefferson, and he was the journalist that revealed Jefferson's affair with
Sally Hemings.
Yeah. Sally Hemings.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting. So it was known then, but really didn't get a lot of real momentum until our time.
Yeah, Callender was jailed by Adams. And when he came out of jail, he was in the Jefferson administration, and he sort of expected a cushy job as a postmaster somewhere or something like that. And Jefferson just dissed him, so he spilled the beans.
Wow. So there is an aside here on libel laws. It took a while for the courts to come around to setting a standard, a long time.
Yeah, it wasn't until, 1964, 68, the Sullivan versus the New York Times case that it made it to the Supreme Court. But a lot of the early presidents and many later ones tried to quash criticism. I was surprised to find that Jefferson was among them, because you often think of him as being an advocate for freedom of speech, freedom of the press.
Yes.
And he opposed the federal sedition laws. But he allowed his supporters in different states to sue for libel. And they typically lost. I think they always lost. Later on, you had Teddy Roosevelt suing the Pulitzer newspapers for libel. He lost as well. But the cases never actually made it to the Supreme Court until the 60s, when you had the public safety superintendent of Montgomery, Alabama, sued over some minor inaccuracies in a story.
Oh, that's right, the Montgomery Advertiser. And that's when the actual malice standard came in, right?
Yeah, the malice standard came in there. But the courts typically would refuse to uphold cases where presidents were suing for libel, and they would find a way to sideline those cases. So there really was a long tradition of the courts upholding the right of anyone to criticize politicians and presidents.
Which we have done a lot through our history, as Ed Battistella points out in his book, Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels, Insulting the President from Washington to Trump. We got choice words for all 45 of the presidents here, and you can join the conversation on the exchange, not to swap insults necessarily, but certainly to ask some questions, share some stories. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a comment from Paul on Sterling Creek. He says, it's chock full of history and humor. This wonderful book is ideal to hole up with while the virus is on the loose. Well done, Ed. That from Paul. Thank you, Paul. And then
I couldn't agree more. Thanks, Paul.
Then Daniel in Ashland has a question. He wants to know how the relationship between the president and the press has developed over time. We talked about this just a bit ago, just now, about things like libel laws, but he has a specific question too about when did the president start insulting the journalists? That from Daniel in Ashland.
Oh yeah, this is interesting, because I think the presidents have always had choice things to say about the press, and you go back to Washington. He talked about the sort of slings and arrows of outrageous, irresponsible journalists, and Lincoln, of course, even censored some newspapers, had them confiscated and destroyed. That didn't go well with his Republican allies in Congress. So there was a sort of period when Lincoln censored the press, and the more aggressive his generals got about that, the more pushback he got from Republican politicians, and he eventually reined a lot of that in. But you get to a point where sort of toward the beginning of the 20th century, I think, where journalism becomes much more of a profession that sees itself as objective rather than partisan.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a lot of, journalists having a lot more clout because you couldn't sort of write them off as, this party's hacks or that party's hacks. So you had people like H.L. Mencken in the beginning of the century and so on, Walter Lippmann, who were tremendously influential, but also quite willing to shoot out a barb. Mencken had things to say about pretty much every president from Teddy Roosevelt through Truman.
Mm-hmm. So in counting up from one, I kind of stalled out at Jefferson, but, at 4, 5, 6, I'm going to skip because Madison, his insults are generally about his height. Monroe was derided as dumb. Quincy Adams got kind of a meh. But, when we get to Andrew Jackson, it seems like a trend is developing that strong presidents, whether you like them or not, make for strong insults.
Yeah, and in Jackson's case, he was really sort of perceived as a he was sort of the first popularly elected president, and in 1824, he actually won the popular vote, but the House of Representatives threw the election to John Quincy Adams, and Jackson basically spent the next 4 years making sure that Adams would be a one-term president. So when he came in, there was plenty of there were plenty of insults thrown at him about his past as a general. He was called a murderer, a cannibal, a bluebeard. He had this sort of confused relationship with his wife, that she had been divorced, but it wasn't clear whether they were whether Jackson had married her before the divorce or after. So she was attacked as a bigamist and an adulterer, and he was attacked as her consort, and she died before he was actually inaugurated. So between the election and the inauguration in 1828, and he never really forgave his opponents.
No, and it's interesting though that when you go down the list of, and it's a long list of stuff that was said about Jackson, we get the bully, which was actually a chant used by Adams' supporters, as you point out, called the ABC of democracy: the adulteress, the bully, and the cuckold. And it went, "Oh Andy, oh Andy, how many men have you hanged in your life? How many weddings make a wife?"
Exactly. It's there are some real gems out there as far as some of the things that were said. One of my favorites was from Alexis de Tocqueville about Jackson. He said he was a man of violent temper and very moderate talents. Hmm. Again, that sort of use of parallelism there. And there was actually something called the Coffin Handbill. And you've probably seen pictures of this. I forget how many coffins. But it was sort of an early bit of negative advertising. And it talked about Jackson having had people hanged during the War of 1812, and that even sort of implying, quoting someone, that Jackson ate the bodies.
Right.
So he called him a cannibal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a monster who shoots, stabs, roasts, and eats his fellow man, said John Taliaferro in a coffin handbill.
Yeah, so it's a bit, you don't find that today as much.
You don't. And now, obviously, Jackson was pretty good at turning things around. I mean, we just mentioned that his supporters basically made light of the things that he was accused of doing, like being a bigamist and stuff like that. But it seems like there are also plenty of presidents who could dish it out but couldn't take it.
Yeah, there were. Some of them could take it quite well. I think of Lincoln and Kennedy. Lincoln was probably the most insulted president of all time, because he was getting it from both the South and the folks in the North, and he generally ignored it. But his successor, Andrew Johnson, was quite thin-skinned. And at one point, he was at giving a speech in the South and talking about the people who were criticizing him, and somebody shouted out from the audience, "Why not hang them?" And And Johnson said, yes, why not?
Yeah, it's interesting, the parallels between Johnson and Trump that we explored a few months ago in a book about Johnson and his impeachment and the way in which he went out to mass rallies and all that sort of thing. So certainly stuff to talk about both of those guys and the other 43 presidents here. Edwin Battistella has written Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels, Insulting the President from Washington to Trump. We have much more to explore with him, and you can join the conversation by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. I want to come back to William Henry Harrison, who you mentioned earlier here. This is president number 9. He only in office a month, but he still got insults, obviously because he'd had a career before he got to the White House. But is he the first president you could find who got called a dotard?
Yeah, I think it had been used a little bit earlier, actually, about Martin Van Buren. And the insult was that, let's see if I can find it here. Van Buren was interesting as well, so I want to come back to him in a second.
Sure.
William Seward talked about Van Buren as a crawling reptile whose only claim was that he had inveigled the confidence of a credulous, blind, dotard old man. So I guess that was a sort of a bank shot at Jackson as well.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson, but then William Henry Harrison, and then also Buchanan, and until it got sort of refound by Kim Jong Il. I think those were probably the only three. So, yeah, you do find these words that go out of fashion for a while.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah, that have dotard come back again after 150 years or more and used it by the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, they must have some really old dictionaries.
That's probably it. They can't afford a more modern one or something. So William Henry Harrison, of course, was the guy who stood out and gave his inaugural speech in the rain and then died of pneumonia a month later, putting a Veep into office for the first time. So what was the tag on John Tyler, his successor?
Yeah, he was basically known as an accidental president. And others were called that as well. Tyler was again, it was one of these situations where his cabinet was sort of debating about whether he should be the interim president or the acting president or what to do in this unprecedented situation. And he just took the oath of office and decided the issue. But he was compared with, he was called an imbecile by ex-president Andrew Jackson, who had no great regard for him. He was called a traitor to the Whigs, a poor imbecile, weak, mad, and a traitor, irrational. And at one point, one of his friends called him a poor, deluded old jackass. And that was a sort of, I guess, I'm not sure if it's a friendly insult or just a characterization, but that was what happened when the 54-year-old Tyler married a 21-year-old woman named Julia Gardner. And they went on to have 7 children, bringing the total of Tyler's offspring to 15.
Wow.
So he was pretty busy.
Boy, no kidding. We'll skip through James Knox Polk, Rough and Ready, Zachary Taylor. Millard Fillmore, I want to come to, also took president. Another his accidency, in a sense, because he took over for the Zachary Taylor when he died. Millard Fillmore was called a wife-made man and doughface?
Yeah. Fillmore had married his school teacher. And I guess the sort of idea was that she basically groomed him and turned him into a kind of presentable lawyer and eventually a politician. But he also became one of the presidents known as a doughface. And that was also applied to Pierce and Buchanan. But the doughfaces were, I had to sort of look this up. It was very tricky. This was a term, it was a sort of a, kind of a Halloween costume without Halloween associated with it, where people would put, they would wear sheets and put dough on their face and use it to pretend to be ghosts and to frighten others. Hmm. I think a Whig politician started to use it in a kind of reverse way, talking about dough faces who were scared of their own shadows or scared of their own principles. And it became used as a Northern politician who sided with the South, who was afraid to take a stand.
So there you can see why Buchanan got into that one. Buchanan deserved a lot more insults, I think, than he got, given that he was the one who was still president in his lame duck period after Lincoln's election, when the Southern states all began seceding. Lincoln obviously took all the trashing through his term. You probably could have made a book of insults just about Lincoln.
There is a book of insults just about Lincoln. A historian did one a few years ago, and it was one of those things where I had to really curate some of the Lincoln insults, because Lincoln and FDR could have taken over the book.
Wow, they really could have. So we have some other people who want to get in on the conversation here and ask about people. Let's see. Let's go to Mark in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. One of the things that I just finished reading since I've been incarcerated here in my home, so to speak, Richard Reeves' book on President Kennedy, one of the things he talks about is Kennedy handing out insults. And about Rockefeller, he said he's got no guts, and about Goldwater, he said he's got no brains. But then one of the things I wanted to ask about was Chester A. Arthur. Has Chester A. Arthur got something that somebody bad said about him? I haven't read much about him.
Yeah, it was interesting. Arthur was another one who took office for a president who died, in this case, Garfield, who was assassinated.
Arthur was an interesting character because he was basically a New York political boss who was associated with, Roscoe Conkling. And he had been fired by Rutherford Hayes. But then he became the vice president for Garfield. Garfield is assassinated by Charles Guiteau, I think. But there were plenty of people that had rough things to say about Arthur, including that he was Conkling's Man Friday. Mm. So that's an insult that sort of shows up again and again, being the puppet of some other politician. Harry Truman was called Thomas Pendergast's bellhop.
Pendergast being the boss in Kansas City, sure.
The boss in Kansas City. So yeah, you're a puppet or a bellhop or a Man Friday. But Mark Twain actually referred to him as a flathead, which was a term that we use fathead now. Uh-huh. But at the time, flathead and fathead were sort of competing terms. Twain later revised his opinion of Chester Arthur upward. But my favorite insult about Chester Arthur was by the president of the steel workers, and they said he was better fitted to be a scullion at Delmonico's than in the White House, and Delmonico's being the famous New York restaurant. Mm-hmm. So it'd be like someone being better suited to be a busboy at whatever.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in there. You mentioned Rutherford Hayes in passing, who lost the popular vote in the 1876 election, but got to the White House in a fairly circuitous deal that is still questioned today. Now, he wasn't his accidency, as some of the presidents who took office upon the death of a president were, but what was his nickname?
His nickname was Rutherfraud. right, playing on Rutherford. And there's an interesting Oregon connection in there, because one of the electoral votes that got allocated was an Oregon electoral vote.
Oh.
So in a sense, Oregon decided the election for...
Samuel Tilden won the popular vote in that election.
Yeah, and Tilden won the popular vote, and there was a commission that was appointed, and the commission had... It was supposed to be evenly split with one neutral person, and I think the neutral person fell away, and it was a sort of uneven commission, to say the least.
Indeed. Let's skip ahead to Teddy Roosevelt. Here again, this is a guy who was, really out there, kind of. He was the creator of the term, the bully pulpit, the idea of the presidency as bully pulpit, and so he had to have some choice insults about him.
Yeah, Teddy was interesting. He was, the Mark Hanna, who was the sort of political boss behind Warren Harding, McKinley. Oh, I always get these Ohioans confused.
Right.
There's a whole series of them, most of them with beards. Hanna called him that damned cowboy. And said that there was only one life between him and the presidency. It turned out to be sort of prophetic.
Really?
But, and I think one of the things that's interesting about Teddy Roosevelt is that he was a literary guy. We sort of think of him as a cowboy. And that came about, when he went west and sort of reinvented himself as a tough guy. But he was basically a sort of bookworm, a writer. But he could sort of find some clever ways of expressing himself. So at one point, Henry James, the writer, referred to Roosevelt as a dangerous and ominous jingo. So that jingo was like the noun form of jingoistic. And Roosevelt shot back to this accusation that he was a blustering militarist by saying that James was a little emasculated mass of inanities, which has a nice sort of rhythm to it, I think.
Yeah, the emasculated part. I mean, here again, this is Teddy Roosevelt casting himself as a tough guy when he came from a rich family on the East Coast, but he was looking like a Westerner, like a rootin' tootin' cowboy kind of guy.
Yeah, it's funny. When he first went into the New York Assembly in 1882, I think he was, in his 20s, and he sort of dressed very fancily. And folks referred to him as our own Oscar Wilde, as the exquisite Mr. Roosevelt, and as the chief of the dudes.
Oh, wow.
The dude ranch. So I think that must have stunned him, and he sort of decided he was going to be a tough guy.
Oh, wow. He really did change his image then. Now, Ed, there are some asides in the book, some sidebars here, and one of them is on the use of the term socialist. And I want to talk about how the use of that has changed over time.
Yeah, it was a sort of interesting and I guess kind of relevant in today's political situation. The sort of earliest uses of the word socialist really meant just someone living in a civilized society. But by the mid-19th century, it had a sort of political sense where it referred to social control of income and property. And today, they're sort of two views of socialism, one involving kind of authoritarian approaches like China, the Soviet Union, centralized state control. The other one involving social democracy, government regulation, tax-supported social net, safety networks, and so on. And it turns out that some of the early progressivists like Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson were called socialists. The actual socialists of the time didn't see them that way, and they united behind Eugene V. Debs,
mm-hmm.
Who ran, I think, five times.
A bunch of times, including once from prison, I think.
Yeah, well, the last time from prison, and he was actually pardoned by Warren Harding, one of the sort of odd things that Harding did that you wouldn't expect. But this sort of socialist tag went on, certainly through the Franklin Roosevelt years. The Chicago newspaper had a series of editorials asking, is Roosevelt a socialist? And the answer was yes.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy, Truman, and even Eisenhower and Nixon were cast as socialists by the far right.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned earlier about Goldwater and his two-fisted, four-square liar about Nixon, because Goldwater thought Nixon was too liberal, and I suppose by today's Republican standards he would be, but times change, and insults just keep on coming. The book is called Dangerous Crooked Scoundrels, Insulting the President from Washington to Trump, now out on Oxford University Press from Ashland's own Edwin Battistella. Ed, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great April.
All right, take care and be safe. That's it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Stay safe. Thanks for listening. Join us next time and have a great day.